It is Friday, July. Oh no, it's August 2nd. August 2nd, 2013. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the sunny suburbs of Chicago. Excuse me. I really appreciate you joining me today on RBN for people who can handle the truth. RBN's website is republicbroadcasting.org. I'm sure that you've noticed the new format. RBN is now associated with Cumulus Media Network Satellite Services, which provides a 24/7 satellite channel to RBN on XDS. That means that 4,000 affiliate stations can pick up all of the RBN programs. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit Spingola.com. Another site that I wish to draw your attention to is SpingolaSpeaks.info, which was created by one of our listeners. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@Spingola.com. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by going to Spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour at 800-313-9443 after we open the phone lines. Our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. And you ought to read these articles. There's a whole index listing of them on the left-hand side of the page. Just amazing, amazing work. Welcome to the program, Carl.
Thanks, Deanna.
Are you there?
How's it with you, then?
Have we lost Carl?
Oh, no, I'm here. Hello?
Oh, okay. I guess I missed. All righty.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, good. Yes, thank you. I don't know what's going on, but glad you're here.
How's things with you then?
Very well. And you?
Oh, same old. You know.
Right.
Get on with things.
Sure.
Right. Our subject for today: National Socialism, the Third Reich, and the occult, as well as the role that Jews play in all this, which is, of course, one of my interests. The first thing to say is that it is a myth, and it is a very badly evidenced myth. It's grown up alongside of the Holocaust. In fact, in many respects, it has become an ancillary to the Holocaust legend. The explanatory power of the myth is related primarily to the subject of what it is talking. It's talking about the Third Reich, it's talking about National Socialism from 1930s to 1940s, and the crimes that are associated with the Third Reich, whether they be real, fake, or otherwise. Now, the key thing to understand is that what this all completely ignores is the Third Reich attitude to Christianity. Now, to understand why it's a myth, we have to understand some of what the Third Reich thought about Christianity. Now, a lot of people get very, very confused about the Third Reich attitude to Christianity because there is a fine differentiation involved, in that it was held that you had freedom of conscience, you could worship who you wished, but the logic was that if you in any way politicized that worship, if you suddenly said, "I'm a Christian" or "I'm a Muslim, therefore the government must do what my religion tells me you should do," then there would be a problem. This is what they called political Christianity or political religion. And they had a whole subsection dealing with that. Also, the Reich attitude has been coloured by interpretations. Now, like the Holocaust, a lot of things get said about it by cherry-picking comments from leaders and so forth. The interesting thing about it is that there is very little evidence of the Third Reich being particularly anti-Christian. In fact, the only really strongly anti-Christian member of the entire there's two anti-Christian members of the bureaucracy, high bureaucracy. That would be Martin Bormann, famously Hitler's secretary, and Stalin's president of the Nazi Party, and Himmler, of course, head of the SS. But the interesting thing is that Himmler was actually far less anti-Christian than Bormann, Bormann being an atheist, Himmler being a pagan or a deist, depending on your view. Now, the important thing to understand with the Nazi Party is that it was a bit like the Republican Party in some respects, in that the Republican Party has a hardcore following of intellectuals who are heavily associated with libertarianism. Now, that doesn't reflect what the Republican Party may put out, may actually believe in its lower tier, at its base, in its general membership, or even among its leadership at times. But at the same time, that is the image that gets projected. In much the same way, the Third Reich had a coterie of neo-pagan and quite anti-Christian intellectuals associated with it who opposed Christianity, but it fundamentally has been coming out in the last, I would say, last decade to 15 years in scholarship that this is that the picture as presented by just reading these intellectuals is completely wrong, and that the Third Reich was very much a Christian state and the Nazi Party was a Christian party, in large part because recent studies of the SA and the Nazi Party membership have shown that, for example, that the big money benefactors that are claimed to have supported the NSDAP, in fact, didn't contribute very much, and that it was actually lots of small donations and so forth. And that these people were often highly Christian and very much, you know, opposed to Bolshevism on religious grounds, opposed to Jews on religious grounds, and so forth. It kind of acts as a point of understanding that we need to sort of get past this idea of, you know, the satanic pagan Reich that was put out. Now, the explanatory of the myth is related to someone's belief or unbelief in the evil of the Third Reich. You have to believe the Third Reich is evil to believe it's an occult state, and you have to part of that is you have to believe that the occult or Satanism or whatever you call it is the paradigm of evil. Therefore, you naturally try and associate the two if you are trying to explain something that you cannot otherwise explain. And the point of bringing up the Christianity of the Third Reich is really quite simple, because it is primarily among American or English-speaking Christians that the belief in this occult Reich is very, very, very common. Indeed, it was in English language literature that this was actually propagated. And the fact is that what they were trying to do by adopting this particular attitude is to explain Hitler, to explain what they perceive to be the evil of the Third Reich, the Holocaust, so-called, and all the other associated crimes. And it was part of a broader campaign to demonize National Socialism, as well as fascism, actually, in order to distance sort of Christianity from them, and therefore allow Christianity to continue and not to be attacked by the left as it was at the time. In essence, it was a kind of reactionary mechanism of saying, well, we're not associated with that because they were in fact devil worshippers, because that in a Christian point of view would be the ultimate evil. And this, of course, has been heavily manipulated by Jews, because the point is that if for a Jew you are promoting in any way nationalism or, you know, patriotic views, then you must be associated with, you know, the devil, or their kind of version of evil, and thus what they sort of project upon the Zionist Christians and the like is this idea that that anything like that is evil, that the expression of what they might call criticism of the Jews, anti-Semitism, the Third Reich, is, you know, was satanic, was part of the occult, was part of a occult conspiracy against the Jews, and it all kind of fits quite nicely in for the Zionist Christians in terms of their ideology.
Indeed. All righty, we are going to a break. We will be back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Carl Radl, R-A-D-L. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. And I'm sure you'll bring up the Thule Society and the occult versus Nazism. I mean, there's a couple of books that really promote this nonsense.
There's not just a couple, there's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah. Well, the two that I was thinking of, the occult roots of Nazism and the Nazi occult and...
The big book, I think, there's two stages in this myth. The first stage is the development of the myth. The myth itself largely comes from a British occultist called Lewis Spence, otherwise unremarkable. But he wrote a book in 1940 called The Occult Causes of the Present War, in which he included two chapters. One was called the Nazi Pagan Church, one was called the Nazi Pagan Religion. Both of which developed this idea of the satanic Nazism, you know, Adolf Hitler being an occult magus doing black magic, to Spence, it was kind of a battle of, you know, British white magic against German black magic, in much the same way that Gerald Gardner, the founder of Wicca, would later write in his Witchcraft Today that there was this big ceremony in the south of England during 1940, during the Blitz, during the potential invasion of Operation Sea Lion, and that these quote white witches drove the Germans away. This is the kind of attitude you're dealing with, but it folds into a much larger attitude in terms of British intellectual life, because the way that the enemies had been presented in the British intellectual discourse, as well as popular discourse, always was as the opponent of Christian Protestantism in England, i.e., England is the true Christian nation with a true Christian mission to the world, and so forth. And for example, the Irish Republican Army and the Republicans in general were styled as being sort of superstitious papists who were against progress. They wanted to create a Bolshevik country in Ireland and so forth. That was the theme there. But when you compare it to the people to the way that the British talked about the Germans in World War One, then you see there's a concordance there, because the British, big British theme of British propaganda in World War One was the Germans were the Hun. They were barbarians. They were pagans. They, you know, the association by the Fathers of the Church with paganism and Satanism. So they were kind of a satanic pagan force. They sort of bayoneted babies. They bayoneted nuns or shot nuns, etc. And this was the kind of propaganda that was put out. And this carried on as a subtext to British right-wing discourse during the 1920s, 1930s, which can be very easily seen by any of your readers who have got Nesta Webster's 1931 book, The Surrender of an Empire, because before Hitler has risen in Germany, she talks about Hitler as being the personification of pan-Germanism, as being this kind of pagan force, this anti-Christian force. And Webster herself talks about the National Socialist Movement as being this kind of anti-Christian force, this force that was possibly controlled by the Illuminati and so forth. And you can see that the premonitions of that, if you look at Subversive Movements and Secret Societies, or whichever way around it is. She has a whole chapter on pan-Germanism, and she argues in much the same way in her Bosch and Bolshevik and so forth. So you get this kind of theme going of this, you know, this pagan force, this, you know, blood-drinking savages, that kind of image. And that then gets reinforced by Lewis Spence, who writes The Occult Present War. It doesn't make a big splash, but it makes an effect. It's part of a bigger campaign that you see mentioned, this idea of the pagan National Socialism in people like Edgar Morin's work, and people like that. But it's at that point, during the war, it's a sub theme at best. It's not a massive thing. But after the war, as I said, Christianity was on the defensive. It needed to explain why it was perceived as having been involved with the Third Reich, and why German Christians and Italian Christians had fought with the Third Reich against the Allies and so forth. So what they began to turn to was this kind of almost trying to find an explanation for the rise of Hitler and the rise of what the Second World War was. And part of that was this creation of the occult Reich myth. And it was really fed by a series of occultists, German occultists, who claimed after the war that Hitler had been their student. They'd known Hitler in the 1920s or during his time in Vienna as an occultist and had contact with him and so forth. Academics just dismissed this pretty much out of hand as a rule because they don't make any sense, and I'll come on to that a bit later. But a lot of Christians picked this up, and they picked it up particularly through a particular book, actually, called The Morning of the Magicians, written by Jacques Bergier and another author, who I can't remember the name of at the top of my head, one of whom was Jewish, one of these authors, and they argued that Hitler was this great magician, and his rhetorical abilities were born of black magic and so forth. Other people who have popularized this myth include Trevor Ravenscroft, who thinks that if you wave a crystal and have dreams, that equates evidence, and he's the big theorist in relation to Hitler and the Spear of Destiny. And then you get, there's a series of French authors like Louis Sundberg, who's also Jewish, who co-wrote The Occult and the Third Reich, which was a big, important book in arguing the case by bringing in the figure of Otto Lahn into the situation, quite ahistorically, I might add, but there you go, as kind of an occult magus who worked with the Third Reich, and so forth. And you get up to these Zionist Christian texts like Dusty Scalar's The Occult and the Third Reich, and then you get to the modern material, like, for example, Peter Levender's The Unholy Alliance.
Right. Yes, all of the there's so much evidence, and when you look at who's written them, it's pretty significant.
Well, it's who's written them as well. It's the fact that they tend to have one or three things in common. Either they are involved with the occult as in quote white magicians, therefore they want to prove the power of the occult. What better way to do that than associate it with the most powerful, with the most evil regime known to man, or as people perceive it, I should say. Or they are associated with very strong, very biblical based Christianity, and they want to kind of treat the National Socialism as the opposite of Israel. Therefore, National Socialism is evil and satanic, and Israel is this kind of godly state. Or they're Jewish. So they've, all three of them have a very obvious motive for writing what they do and for espousing what they do. But it's just interesting the way it all works. And for a great example of this kind of where scholarship has completely rejected the conclusions of this popular literature is on the famous table talk of Hitler. Hitler's table talk, sorry, that was produced by Trevor Roper. When it's actually the anti-Christian comments in there actually derive from a man named François Genoux, who was an anti-Christian National Socialist who survived the war and acquired this text of the Bormann document, as it's sometimes called, and he, we believe, added the text, according to German scholars as of late, but this has yet to filter through to the English-speaking world by and large. And of course you often see these groups, these like people like Peter Levender, use the table talk habitually, and they don't take into account the fact that this has been completely rejected by scholarship.
Indeed. All righty, we are going to a break. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. This is just very interesting because this is so prevalent, these beliefs about the occult. And you can see now the way that you're explaining it, the motivation behind it all.
Yeah, I mean, it's just very much a case of, shall we say, selective interpretation in terms of history. I mean, it's very, very common, as I'm sure you and most of the listeners, if not all of the listeners, know in terms of the Third Reich, in terms of modern history, as well as to some extent, history in general. But it's very much a case of you have to know who is writing the history, because if you don't know who is writing the history, then you don't know what biases, what you know, intellectual requirements or ideological needs are being brought to the table. And that's something that has certainly come out in the in relation to the Third Reich in history, in that there's a lot of people who have a very deep ideological need to see the Third Reich as the paradigm of evil, and thus they link it to just about anything they consider to be evil. To give you an example, there is a an anti-Islamist author who's a Zionist Christian who believes that the Third Reich was going to be an Islamic state. Now, how he gets that, I really don't know. I've read his book and I read it and I thought, okay, what are you talking about? Because basically he works on the assumption that one person's book is going to be the foundation of this Islamic State. And it's completely balmy. But you get some idea of just the kind of, you know, belief systems you are dealing with when you deal with the Third Reich and perceptions about it. And a great example is, again, with relationship with Christianity, is that it's only really begun to come out in the academic literature in the last 10, 20 years, as I said. But we've begun to see Bormann as being the key to this whole, it being mentioned as the key to this whole myth, because he is the one who prevented the direct link between a Christian churches and the Nazi Party. For example, he categorically refused on many different occasions throughout the existence of the Third Reich to allow any a swastika to be put in any church, to allow Mein Kampf to be read at any church, for any kind of official NSDAP symbolism to be used in any church. And he wouldn't acknowledge any of the anti-Jewish Christian organizations that were quite important to the period where the socialism was trying to rise to power. And conversely, the neo-pagan elements, as I brought out, were quite influential as think tanks, because, for example, the Annaner, but the SS's think tank, was primarily associated with paganism, particularly its two heads, Hermann Wirth and Walter Wust. Himmler was, of course, as well as the Minister for Agriculture for most of the Third Reich, Walther Darley. And then you've got the figure of Otto Lahn, who I'll come into in a minute. And then you have also Karl Maria Willigut, who is sometimes called Himmler's Magus. Again, all very closely associated with this neo-pagan intellectual grouping, but themselves not powerful except for Himmler and Darley. Excuse me. Now, briefly point out about Otto Lahn. There's a lot of myths about Otto Lahn, mainly because he is still a New Age a darling, if you like. He's a figure they like because of his two books, Heretics Journey and Lucifer's something. I can't remember the names off the top of my head. And he talks about, you know, his quest to link. The Holy Grail with the Cathar movement and so forth. Now, Rahn himself was a bit weird because he was not a pagan. He didn't particularly like Christianity, but at the same time, he wasn't anti-Christian in the sense of being intellectually so. He was opposed to the inquisitional style of Christianity, particularly as enunciated by people like Bernard of Guy. He eventually killed himself, well, so we think, in 1939, because he was a bit, I think we think he was an upset, he was possibly bipolar and may have had a bit of a rough time because there'd been charges of homosexuality leveled against him and so forth, and he probably killed himself, to be fair. And he's often painted by one of the Jewish authors I mentioned, Louis Sundberg, as being one of these key pagan authors. In fact, it's, as I said, he was nothing of the kind. He was actually more of a Gnostic, if he was anything. And it's this kind of thing. They take a figure. They'll take one figure. Often in each book, we'll take a different figure or a different organization and attribute the Third Reich's occult nature to that particular individual. And Otto Lahn is one of the favorites. Comparatively, Karl Maria Willigut is less known, but he's arguably more important, being a key figure in terms of this promotion of neo-paganism in the Third Reich, and he was in many ways the designer of the famous Death Head rings and so forth.
Okay.
He was actually he was discovered by the SS in 1936, if memory serves, that he had served time in a mental asylum, and he was pretty much removed from the SS forthwith after that.
Let me ask you a question about Bormann. But Bormann is a very interesting character. Why did he try to disconnect Christianity and the NSDAP? What was his motive?
Because
there,
he hated it. The only thing about one of the big things about Bormann that we know is that he hated Christianity in a way that it's very difficult to actually locate the origin of it. It's just this broad hatred of Christianity in total, in any form, in any way. And Bormann was, in many senses, he was the only leader apart from Goebbels who was an atheist. But unlike Goebbels, he didn't have tact about it. He didn't say, you know, okay, I don't believe it, but I will allow people to believe it. I will allow other people to believe it. And that's the problem with Bormann, is that we don't know precisely the origins of his hatred of Christianity. All we know is that he hated it, and he hated it so much that he prevented an awful lot of associations that may have been helpful, may have not been helpful to the Third Reich at the time. And in doing so, it kind of created, laid the foundations for the myth of Occult Reich, because it creates a false distance between the NSDAP in Germany and German Christian thought at the time, compared to the NSDAP. It's just it's one of these little things of history where you get someone who basically rewrites the book, the historical book, by being in the right place at the right time, and then their rewrite sort of plays into the ideological preoccupations of a given moment.
Okay.
In much the same way, a common figure who's brought up is a man named Guido von List. In fact, it's just Guido List, von being the aristocratic thing that a lot of occultists, in quotes, liked to bring up at the time, who wrote for various Volkish periodicals, what we call Volkish, as in folkish, as in nationalist, as in patriotic, periodicals that National Socialists or early National Socialists had written with, or involved with. For example, he wrote for Theodor Fritsch's The Hammer, and so forth. The interesting thing about that is the fact that he's often brought up, but no one often explains how he fits, how he's supposed to fit in, apart from the people like Nicholas Goodrich Clark, who point out very rightly that he doesn't really fit in. He's a figure. He's basically an ideologue and a bit of a weird, some very, very strange ideas on the outside of the Volkish scene, who happens to share a common ground with a lot of people who later became involved in the National Socialism. A classic one, and I'm sure you've heard of it, is a chap named Lanz von Liebenfels, a former monk, a former Cistercian monk at Heiligenkreuz Abbey. He championed an idea he called theozoology, which is, I'm not going to get into the ideological position of it, but basically he sees the Aryan race was a sort of a divine race, and every other race was a kind of apelings. He called them sodomite apelings, and so forth. It was it's quite a bizarre character. The best of times. He had a lot of support. He had a lot of readers. But the interesting thing about Lanz von Liebenfels is his claim to association with Hitler. He claims that in 1909, Hitler turned up at his door, at his office door in Vienna, and he wanted two numbers of his periodical, Ostara, to complete his collection.
Oops. Okay, we're going to a break. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is semiticcontroversies.blogspot.com. Alrighty, this is just really fascinating. I just love this. I like to hear you're just such a scholar. I just really appreciate your work.
Thank you. Okay, so we were talking about Liebenfels and the fact that he claims in 1951, I should point out, that Hitler turned up in 1909 and he could remember him in 1909, this insignificant man, basically, who wouldn't have been well-dressed at all, who turned up in 1909 at his office and said, I'm looking for two back issues to complete my collection of Astala, his Liebenfels magazine. And once you understand that that's everything that Lanz von Liebenfels is based on, his connection with the Third Reich, you begin to sort of understand that there is no connection. It's just Liebenfels who in the early 1930s and late 1930s began to claim that the NSDAP and all fascist movements were in fact acolytes of his. And he was actually silenced by the NSDAP in 1938 after having been sued by them in 1934 for his statements. It's just this kind of thing that Liebenfels is used, but he isn't actually a decent source at all. He's just a source that everyone uses because he seems to have a cogent story. But then, if once you look at it and say, well, in 1951, how could you remember someone who was in 1909 and who wouldn't have been important at that point or even recognisable as the later man, then you ask the question of why. Why does he say this? And the answer is very simple. By 1951, he has become an irrelevance. He wants to become, you know, a famous figure.
Of course.
And that is the same. It's the same story of many such German occultist legends. And that brings us nicely on to something you mentioned earlier called the Thiel Society. Now, the thing about the Thiel Society was that it was formed from various very different groups, for example, the German Orden and so forth, who were just basically aristocrats, industrialists, German nationalists, who had occult ideas. Now, the Thiel Society is a bit of a weird one, precisely because it does have a connection with the NSDAP, but it's not the connection that a lot of these books make out, because they leave out some key information. For example, the Thiel Society, its members were largely, as I said, aristocrats and industrialists. They were not run-of-the-mill workers. They had a couple of run-of-the-mill workers members. And in 1919, they created a group. It was an official working group, which was supposed to propaganda ideas, and it was headed up by a man named Karl Harrer, and as its president, who was a sports journalist, and Anton Drexler, who, as many will know, was the original founder of the NSDAP as its main activist. Basically, they spent 7 months talking about what they were going to do until Drexler sat down and said, "Okay, let's create a political party to advocate nationalist policies." And and where everyone gets confused, they say, the Thiel Society created the NSDAP. Well, no, it didn't. Yes, a member of the Thiel Society was key in doing so, but it is but one of many groups that promoted a very similar ideology at the same time, and it's just one of many that many people were associated with, and Drexler himself was associated with other groups as well, and so forth. It's one of these things where if we were to take this kind of logic and apply it to the history of Christianity, we would say, for example, that Christianity was at its root a Gnostic religion, when today most Christians would reject that out of hand. But it's the same logic being applied. And effectively, and despite the rumours, at this time, no major NSDAP members were members of this party. That includes Hess, Röhm, Rosenberg, Göring, and Fedder. Now, the interesting thing that usually gets brought up is, for example, Rosenberg was a member, Hess was a member, and so forth. That isn't the case. They were not members. What connection they did have with the Thiel Society was that they gave a couple of invited lectures before the members of the Thiel Society, and we know this because we have the Thiel Society's membership rolls.
Indeed.
And there is no point do these people become members of the Thiel Society. Hitler certainly wasn't, and that myth again actually comes from Trevor Ravenscroft. He wrote that was the case, and it's completely false. And another common allegation is that Dietrich Eckart, who was Hitler's mentor, wrote Bolshevism Between Moses and Lenin. And he is said to have been a member of the Thule Society. Again, that's not the case. He was a member of what they call the List Society, so he was interested in the work of Guido von List, but that doesn't make him unusual in the Volkish Right at the time. And the interesting thing about Eckhart is that he was key to the purchase of the Volkischer Beobachter, sometimes translated as the racist observer, more properly translated as kind of the national observer would be closer to the reality, I would argue. The Thule Society did indeed purchase the Volkischer Beobachter when it was a paper in, I think it was 1913 or 1914. It didn't be published. It purchased it when it was commercially failing. But by July 1919, the Thule Society was falling apart. It was its founder, who was Rudolf Zubotendorf, had been basically rejected by his membership because of his association with the Bavarian Soviet Republic, which is of course Jewish led, and the fact he had given or leaked the membership lists of the Thule Society to the Cheka
group.
And they proceeded to go and kill large numbers of the Thule Society.
Right. So
by April 1919, the Thule Society had rejected Zubotendorf, and by June 1919, he had stopped attending any Thule Society meetings whatsoever. And he became a kind of recluse. He became a figure. He was insignificant. He was so insignificant that the Third Reich never did anything about him, never cared about him, in spite of going after different people who were perceived to be enemies or had damaging information about leading members at a later date. For example, the famous Poison Kitchen, as it was called, newspaper that was launched against Third Reich by a Catholic journalist in Bavaria. That kind of people. He wasn't perceived as a threat. If he had been in any way as important as he himself claims in his memoirs, then he would have at least been clamped down on a bit, but no one particularly cared about him. And you can see that in the fact that in the sale for the Volkischer Beobachter, he sold it in July 1919. He sold basically a half interest to the NSDAP, to future NSDAP members like Gottfried Feder and Eckhart and so forth. And then in 1920, it became the official NSDAP paper. But by that time, it was a completely different newspaper from it had been under Thule. It had been a commercial failure under Thule. It became to be a commercial success under the NSDAP. And that, in many ways, became the foundation of the Volkischer Beobachter. But, again, it there's no relation to the Thule Society, other than the fact the paper happened to have been bought by the Thule Society beforehand, who, again, are just one group of many within this, within the Bavarian what we call the far right at this time. There was many other groups who were dealing with similar ideas. You had, for example, you had the Uni Club, you had the, the German Order, you've got the Arminer Schaft, you've got the Reichshammerbund, you've got all these different groups who are operating more or less in the same area, more or less in the same intellectual turf, and they have a lot of connections between them and so forth. I mean, the interesting thing about it is that there is an odd historical figure called who we only know by his pseudonym Tanhali, who figures very prominently in. He's a member of the Thule Society, and he's a member of the List Society. He has a lot to do with Eckhart and so forth. But he suddenly disappears about in the 1920s. Presumably, he died. We just don't know who he is historically.
All righty, we will be back at 6 after the hour, 6 minutes after the hour. So stay tuned. Whoops, I'm sorry. Oh, my goodness, I can't believe it. I'm sorry, my mic was muted. That's what happens when I take a drink of water. All righty, this is Deanna. This is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. And our guest today is Carl Rattle. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. Oh, gosh. gosh. How embarrassing. All righty. Carl, welcome back.
It happens to the best of us, doesn't it?
Well, I cut my mic when I at the end of the last hour and just forgot to, you know, 6 minutes goes by and I just forgot it was muted, so.
Oh, well. Started talking to him to mute him.
Right, and I couldn't understand why they didn't cut the music and what was going on. I mean, I talked louder and louder, and still the music played on and on. Oh, the poor producer. Anyway.
Oh, dear. All right. Just to round off the Thule Society, I thought I would quote possibly the most, the most important historian in English, anyway, of this particular phenomenon. That's Nicholas Goodrich Clark in his The Occult Roots of Nazism, which, if you're interested, I thoroughly recommend picking up. He says, on page 150, the precise relationship of the new party, which is the NSDAP, with the workers' ring of the Thulean inspiration, remains indeterminate. Franz Dehlin, a Thule member and DAP speaker, which is Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, which is the precursor of the NSDAP, claims to have discussed the founding of the party with Haller, who is the president of this Thule Society group, at the hotel Via Jahrzeiten. But Drexler's pamphlet Mein politisch Erwachen, 1919, mentions neither Dermal or Haller, nor the foundations of the party, although the minutes of the ring indicate no discussions of racist Weltanschauung beyond a rudimentary form of antisemitism. It is probable that Haller's Volkisch ideas infiltrated the ring and influenced Drexler and the DAP, which was transformed a year later, at the end of February 1920, into the National Socialist German Workers' Party, NSDAP. However, the DAP line was predominantly one of extreme political and social nationalism and not based on the Aryan racist occult pattern of the German Orden. What he's basically saying is that the two groups are very, very different. They may look intertwined, but in fact, if you look at their ideologies, you look at the fact that the DAP was not in line with the Thulean ideas, then it is clear that the two groups are not the same. They're linked by members, yes, but they're not, that their membership, not necessarily, they don't necessarily believe in fact the same things. They don't propagate the same things, certainly. Now, the other thing about the Thule Society is the chap who ran it, who, as I've mentioned, Rudolf Zubotendorf, who liked to call himself a baron. He wasn't a baron, but he liked to do it because it got him mistresses, of which he had several. But the interesting thing about Zubotendorf is the time he spent before the First World War in Greece, because he spent his time with a particular family called the Telmudi family, who just so happened to be bankers, Greek Jews, and Freemasons all at once. This was a family that was very closely associated with Kabbalism. And he picked up a lot of his ideas from this particular family, as we believe. And it's interesting to note that this Jewish, sort of Jewish attitude to Zubotendorf, and the fact that after June 1919, as I said, his life fell apart pretty much, and he was a non-entity. So in the 1930s, it was claimed that he had a conversation with Trevor Ravenscroft of Hitler and the Spear of Destiny fame, that he had influenced Hitler, he had been Hitler's mentor, and so forth. And that is where we get the entire idea of the Thule Society ruling the NSDAP, and because what happened in the 1970s and 1960s was that people began to dig into the history of the Third Reich a bit and the history of the NSDAP, and they noted the fact that there was a limited amount of concordance between these two societies, and they just said, okay, one society equals that. So because the Thule Society may have had a limited crossover with the DAP, this then means that the NSDAP was an occult phenomenon and so forth.
Which is ridiculous. I mean, if you applied that same reasoning to things that we become involved with, like we might attend a meeting of some site, but that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean a thing. Just because you and for instance, you mentioned that that Rosenberg had and Hess had spoken at the Thule Society. Well, they were trying to form the party. They were trying to grow. Of course they're going to go out and speak to any group or any organization that had listeners, correct?
Yeah, precisely. The same reason that Goebbels would actually encourage communists to come to his speeches, because if communists came, there would be a riot. A riot would get him in the papers. He didn't want to hurt people, but that's the best way to do what you're looking to do. The same thing, if you look at, for example, the SPLC's literature and the literature on the far right from the far left. In fact, you'll see that they tend to say, ah, but he's a member of you know, the Ku Klux Klan, he was a member of the Nazi Party. Ah, the two must be linked because one member was there. Ah, he must, you know, this is a concordance, as they like
sure.
to call it. It's that kind of reasoning of sometimes it's called quote mining. It's like you're saying, you've been associated with something once, or you've spoken before them once, thus you must be a member, you must eternally be a member of that particular party, and so forth. And we have our fair share of those kind of people who use that kind of reasoning on the side of patriotism and the far right and so forth. But there's also plenty of them on the far left, and there's plenty of them in liberalism and so forth. I mean, the amount of times I'm sure you've read of people talking about, in quotes, Nazi conspiracies to rule over America with
the Fourth Reich,
the Fourth, the Rich, the famous of the books, and so forth. It's that kind of reasoning that then brings out this kind of loony, this lunatic sort of associations. And a great one is the figure of Johann Stein, who claimed in the 1930s, 1940s, that he had met Hitler in a bookshop in Vienna from 1908 to 1909, and he picked up a book that Hitler owned, which was the text of Parsifal, Wagner's Parsifal, and that he read these notes, and they showed a dark power, a knowledge of this dark forces and so forth. And it was in the bookshop of a man called Ernst Plitschke in Vienna. And apparently he got to know Hitler, and he taught him so much. And Hitler was always this great magus. He was this great black magician. And that's the only place his great oratorical abilities could have come from and so forth. But the problem with this, of course, is the fact that, okay, Hitler wasn't that. It was in Vienna at the time. And Stein wasn't. And then we got the problem with the bookshop. Well, the problem is that there is no bookshop registered to Ernst Plechka in Vienna at the time. And in fact, there's no one in Austria. There's no bookshop in Austria at the time associated with him. And we do not have any record that this man actually existed, other than Stein's claims much later in life. It's that kind of problem. It's people, you've got these occultists saying, ah, yes, I was associated with Hitler, thus I'm important, thus I'm powerful, thus I'm, you know, look at me, I've caused all this destruction of knowledge.
Sure. Interesting. All righty, we will be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a Source Reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. Okay, so people usually, they just accept what somebody says. They don't bother to check to see whether there was a bookstore in Vienna or anywhere else. They just don't bother to look at the facts. And that's just human nature, I think.
Yes, certainly when it comes to things like this. This is why you tend to say there's three levels of literature. There is, you've got your basic popular literature, which is your average, you know, quick book on, you know, our very short introduction to this. Then you've got your mid-brow literature, which is kind of your Barnes and Noble philosophy section. And then you've actually got what you call scholarly literature. You've got the highbrow stuff. You've got people who actually go out there, they research things, and sometimes they're very dry authors, and they make very, very specific work. They do very specific work, and they tend to myth bust, if you want a better term.
Right.
And a lot of people have accepted the myths about the occult Reich and the, you know, satanic Nazism and how it oppressed Christianity and so forth, because it suits them as well. But if you want a comparison, the Holocaust is actually a very good one. It's in part because it covers the same ground. It's basically what has been described as a giant with feet of clay. There is a book after book after book after book which says, "Ah, yes, Hitler was a black magician. The Thule Society created the NSDAP. Otto Rahn was a big magus, and Willy Gutt was important. Guido List was in the background somewhere. Hitler was in a bookshop in Vienna reading about black magic in 1908, 1909, etc." You go back layer upon layer upon layer upon layer, and then you suddenly find that it's undercut by something absolutely unacceptable in terms of evidence, like Lanz von Liebenthal in 1951 saying, I was Hitler's inspirer, I'm important, look at me. And you get the same thing with Subotendorf, you get the same thing with Johann Stein, and so forth. It's this kind of attitude of, I want to be remembered, I want to be viewed as important, but yet I'm not viewed as important at the moment, so I must make my contribution to history. It's a bit like some of the people like Hermann Rausching, who went over to the Allies and produced some of the two worst books on Hitler that have probably ever been written. It's just this kind of attitude of, if you pile enough references on top of something, then people will accept it without question. Most people won't check a reference. They will just look at it and go, "Oh, look, he's quoted, or he or she has quoted, that book says that. Okay, oh, that sounds good because the title is good. Oh, look, it's in French. Oh, look, it's in German." And that it kind of gives you the false mystique of intellectualism. And you see the same thing in literature of the Jews, for example, on various different subjects. They like to quote work upon work upon work upon work, which supposedly has this evidential basis behind it. But when you get back to the basis, it doesn't actually support the assumptions that have been made on the basis of the literature. So you get this layer upon layer upon layer of literature. And it's like that famous famous instance within revisionism when Carlo Mattone, the revisionist historian of the Holocaust, said in his one of his articles, he said, "I looked at the Holocaust of the Gypsies. Now, I went back through the literature. I said, okay, well, I want to look at all the authors and see where they're getting their information from." So he went back and back and back and back, and then he found that the two principal authors, which basically everything is built off of, the Gypsy Holocaust, actually cited each other. They didn't cite a document; they cited each other. So you've got a case where you've got these two authors citing each other, and then everything's built on top of them. So it's a kind of bizarre scenario where no one has checked, no one has thought to check, and then someone does, and they find out it's complete nonsense. Basically, it's like anything. It's like academic theory. Scholarship changes over time. I mean, for example, most listeners will have never heard, or probably never heard of the fact that in the last 10 years there's been a very general academic consensus that the Cathars, the people that Otto Rahn was so enamored with, never existed, and they were in fact an imaginary phantom made up of lots of different smaller groups who were working to a previous interpretation of Christianity. That kind of little thing that's not popular, but it's much more solid intellectually, as people have worked with it and sort of ironed out the kinks in it and so forth. It's that kind of thing that doesn't come down to the literature a lot of people read. These days I don't think most people read a lot of literature anyway. I think they would just watch videos. And the Occult Reich is again a great example where you get videos which purport to prove this. The most recent is called the Nazi Gospels. It includes a documentary. It's a very well done documentary, but it's about as factual as, well, a documentary about UFOs landing in my back garden. It's not exactly factually correct. In spite of having lots of interviews with some scholars, it also but most of its people who are cited, who are talking it, are not scholars. There's Klaus Fischer, there is a historian from Oxford, and there is Nicholas Goodrick Clark, and then you've got people like Bill Yen, you've got people like Peter Lavender, who cite, basically they try every possible claim to say that this occult right existed, and they claim that That this is great. I mean, Peter Levitt felt very into my amusement, said in it, oh yes, the paganism is always Satanism, really, effectively. And that's the kind of attitude you're dealing with. People who will associate one thing with another thing because that is their worldview. That is what they believe to be the case. And of course, Jews are very keen to promote this kind of belief because it is kind of acts as a shield. Because for the Zionist Christians, because Zionist Christians will always say, oh, but Hitler was evil because he, you know, thought society, devil worship, Satanism, paganism, everything possible other than to say Hitler might have had a lot of Christian support. Because if Hitler had a lot of Christian support and he didn't seduce, in quotes, seduce them with black magic or what have you, then that makes their interpretation of the Third Reich very, very tenuous, and that puts the kind of devil of their piece, of their kind of worldview, into question as to really, was it a devil? And that then causes all sorts of problems, because that then ultimately says, well, why? Why is this regime, why was it supported? And they have to research it, and they have to think about it, and that causes all sorts of problems to occur in their own heads. And it's quite common also that people who will write about the occult, in quotes. I think Michael Howard, for example, is in his The Occult Conspiracy, will just include the Thule Society angle. They won't include the rest of it. They'll just include the Thule Society angle as if it was established fact, as if historians supported it, which they don't, and so forth. It's just kind of this attitude of we'll just include whatever facts we like, and then we hope that no one else will look at the literature kind of thing. It's bizarre, and you see it, for example, in the Occult Reich documentary. All it cites is all these, in quotes, connections and so forth. That's so common when you're trying to describe a conspiracy, but you don't have any evidence of the conspiracy. So, for example, you need to prove that he talked to him, that he influenced him, not that, oh, he knew him. Because if he knew him, we don't know there was any influence there, there was no involvement there. You know, everyone has, I don't know, maybe 200, 300 acquaintances or what have you at the time. So, you know, it's not unusual for people to know each other. It's just you have to prove friendship, you have to prove, you know, influence. And that's, for example, the best example of that kind of logic and that kind of, you know, well, I must actually prove every connection is Carol Quigley's the Anglo-American establishment, where he argues the existence of what he calls the Round Table Conspiracy. It's fascinating.
Right.
It's how you should argue that theory, or that kind of theory.
All right, we are going to a break. We will take calls when we return, so be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Carl Rattle. He is the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. I got 15 emails yesterday from one person claiming that the Jesuits were behind everything. And you can find books with all these kinds of claims, and you think, okay, but when you look at who wrote them, you'll find that a Jew wrote some of them, and when you look at the sources and the information, I mean, it's just a bunch of hogwash.
Yes, I've seen them. I remember, I've actually been called a Jesuit before. Someone, I remember I had an argument with someone about Jesuits, and they ended up calling me, they ended up saying, yeah, are you a Jesuit? Are you, you know, are you part of this, how many Jesuits are out there, sort of stalking YouTube? I was like, Jesuit order stalking YouTube. You can't believe it sometimes.
Exactly.
People will believe in anything as long as it seems cogent. And yeah, the classic thing is with Jesuits is the fact they kind of view them as kind of a nefarious order that's going to take over the world. And so I think they've only had one or two recent books that have claimed it that I recall. Like, I remember one in 2000, but I tend to read them on occasion and just shake my head. When you want a good laugh, or you can read David Icke, possibly.
I mean, some of the stuff that he does include is probably true, but then when he brings in all this other stuff, it just
it's like,
so terrible.
It's like, so it says, oh yes, the one I always like was is his view that that the Jews are the Jews are not responsible for anything. The only reason that there is you know, this Jewish influence in the world is because the, in quotes, shape-shifting Rothschild lizards are, you know, are ruling over the Jews, and the Levites, you know, of the Bible, were really black magic satanic priests who were actually shape-shifting lizards as well. And I remember reading it and thinking, what?
Right. And the Jesuits in charge of Hollywood? Oh, please.
The Jesuits in charge of Hollywood. That's a new one.
Yes,
so I don't see any priestly collars anywhere in Hollywood somehow.
No. All righty. We do have some callers lining up. Why don't we take a call? Let's take Robert in Missouri. Robert, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Deanna and Carl. I wanted to get into this thing about that I've read about maybe 20 years ago from some eschatological Bible prophecy folks that talked about Hitler used to look at the spear of destiny, the spear of Longinus in the Vienna Museum, where he was supposedly sat there and meditated in front of this spear for hours, and there was a big black shape of some sort of demonic presence. And somewhere it says that he gave himself over to its will. And I wondered, was this spear actually there in Vienna during his,
it,
you know,
formative
year?
It was actually there, but that's Trevor Ravenscroft. he's the one who came up with the whole spear of destiny. Yes, without it, Hitler lost the war and he lost his powers. But just to get, I've got a quote from Ravenscroft just to give you kind of a idea of how insane the man is, or was, I should say. He says, Dietrich Eckart contrived to develop and open the centers in the astral body of Adolf Hitler, giving him the possibility of vision into the macrocosm and means of communication with the powers of darkness, utilizing his memoirs of a past incarnation as the Landulf of Capua in the 9th century. By divulging the secret doctrine, Haushofer expanded Hitler's time consciousness and awakened him to the real motives of the Luciferic principality which possessed him, so that he would become the conscious vehicle of its evil intent in the 20th century. It's like, that's the kind of rubbish that he writes.
Right.
It was actually, it was in the museum, but it's like, it's just the fact that the fact he went there and may well have seen it, because in Sydney he visited a lot of museums and libraries at the time, but there's no evidence of him being particularly interested in it, other than the fact that it was a treasure and it was worth a lot, as a relic. Thus, it was of interest to the Third Reich's, cultural, activities. That's about the sum of it. It's just, you know. Crap.
Now,
sorry.
What about this? What about this so-called fascination he had with Madame Blavatsky and then Nicholas Rorick and this whole side of the house? You know, the theosophical stuff. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, it's related to his. It's related to the claims that he was in any way, some way associated with the Thule Society, the Liss Society, because they drew impart some of their ideas from Madame Blavatsky and her The Secret Doctrine. The basis for this seems to be the fact that because Madame Blavatsky uses the word Aryan repeatedly in her The Secret Doctrine and her other books, that therefore she must have had some association with the, it's in quote, occult conspiracy behind Hitler. In reality, there's so little that any kind of connection, or even that Hitler read The Secret Doctrine, that there's no evidence of it. It's just one of these things that it was invented, if memory serves, by the Morning of the Magicians, Louis Powell's and Jacques Bergier, as if Powell's was Jewish. And they then basically propounded this belief in this, in this kind of connection between Aryosophy, which is Blavatsky's idea, and National Socialism and Hitler, in order to argue this idea that magic was very, very powerful and that it was a rational force in the world and needed to be harnessed and so forth. It was basically a partisan argument, misciting and misunderstanding literature, if you want honest opinion.
All right, one more quick one. How
sure.
about the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute and the Rockefellers and the worship of Margaret Sanger? Could you tie some of that? Is any of this true? Or, you know, you hear about this from Alex Jones and the rest.
Well, sort of. It's a weird one. Because it's nothing to do with the occult side of the Third Reich at all. It's to do with core ideology of it's to do with eugenics and the fact that Planned Parenthood does have a similar ideology in terms of what they call negative eugenics as does as did the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, Eugenics and Genetics. And basically all that they shared was the fact that they agreed on a principle that people should have less children, or suitable people should have more children, unsuitable people should have less, and so forth. It's basically that. All that is the fact that you had a bunch of foundations who were supporting different groups and so forth. But there isn't any real connection, because there are quite a lot of American groups supporting Third Reich policies, there are American groups supporting anti-policies, and vice versa. It was quite a bizarre relationship at times in terms of funding. But, you know, it's just one of these things where the eugenics side of it is often overstated completely, and the fact is that American eugenicists did like the Third Reich, and they did support it, but the connection isn't nearly as close. It's more of a case of the Americans viewed it as a case of they're making advancements because Germany was the big player in science at the time. They're making advancements. We want to copy this, and that was brought out in, for example, the publications of the Cold Spring Harbor. People associated with it and that kind of thing, and people like Charles Melidia, I think his name is one of them. Sorry.
I have one observation, and that's this. Everything that's projected onto the Third Reich and the Germans, the racial supremacist aspect and the Holocaust mass murder aspect, actually is kind of it's a ploy, because the real racial supremacist and the real Holocaust that was going on in Eastern Europe with the Russians was being done by the very people that played the victim to the German, demonization campaign. And so it's like it was a great little ploy to cloak their own actions with, you know, the supremacist writings of rabbis for hundreds and hundreds of years and the mass murder of, you know, well up over 60 million people by the, you know, the Jewish Bolsheviks, which is, you know, it's just, I mean, you got to give it to them. They're a cunning and smart bunch of individuals that can, you know, cloak. Go ahead, what you're going to say to that?
No, I was just agreeing with you. Carry on, please.
Right. I mean, it's just amazing that, you know, with the total domination of just about all of the world's media, how they have basically projected onto the Germans the very things that they did behind the scenes. Well, not even really behind the scenes, but just out in the open with total media domination, to where it was just a blackout of the real crimes of the 20th century. And then, you know, you see Mao Zedong with this guy Epstein and the other Jewish characters behind him, where there was another 70 million people who got killed.
Yeah, and you got Che Guevara, who is supported by, who is primarily brought out by a Jewish newspaper reporter, and Castro himself, who's probably part Jewish, and so forth. I mean, they're not exactly the nicest people in the world, are they?
No, indeed. Well, we are going to a break. Robert, if you have another question, you may stay over the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Carl Rattle, the author of Communism and the Jews, a source reader. His website is SemiticController.blogspot.com. And Rick in the chat room said, well, that is what psychopaths do. They blame the victim. And in regard to what Robert had said. And I think Robert is still on. Robert, did you have another question?
Yeah, one last real quick thing. Henry Kissinger made a statement not that long ago about Israel won't exist in 10 years. And I just got this book by Tex Mars, his latest one, called DNA Science and the Jewish Bloodline. And it ties in together basically through DNA study that Arthur Koestler, author of the 13th Tribe, his theory was right. Basically, that modern-day Ashkenazi Jewry is the Turk-Mongol extraction, Kurdish, and the rest of it.
We had Tex on the program yesterday.
Oh, dang it. I missed it. I'm going to have to get in the archives. I wanted to know if Carl thinks that the the Jewish elite, like Kissinger and the rest of them, know that the gig is up. Now the DNA science is proving that, you know, the folks that are laying claim to the land because they're Abraham's descendants truly aren't Abraham's descendants. And if that's the reason why Kissinger might have said that.
Well, Kissinger, when Kissinger said that, I think he's referring to the fact that the Jews in Israel, the fact that Israel is a parasitic state, its economy cannot exist without massive aid. And that's been echoed by a couple of people lately, the fact that Israel, if it doesn't change, will cease to exist in 10 to 20 years because, well, the resistance that is now forming against the Israel lobby, in fact, the gig is up with the Israel lobby, and the fact that everyone knows that it's real, everyone knows it's very powerful, and they know it's the Jews, and the fact you've got the left and the right agreeing on this Israel lobby has to go, because they're causing problems. As to Mars's book, I disagree on the origin of the Jews, in that I know that it's often asserted that the genetic studies support it. In fact, the genetic studies support the opposite, that the Jews are who they say they are, but there was this great empire. This was this empire that converted and so forth. And if you want a counterbalance to someone like Mars's arguments about the Khazars, I suggest reading the Kevin Allen Brooks, The Jews of Khazaria, partly because he himself is very sympathetic to the Khazaria hypothesis, as it's called. But he says, well, the evidence isn't there. The fact is that there probably has some reference, and genetic studies suggest there is something. It's just that genetic studies, all they say is there is a sort of a Near Eastern element to the Jews in terms of they're up in the Caucasus a bit. And that is no surprise to any historian of Jewish affairs, because the Jews have been known to have been up there since at least the time of Mithridates. That's before Rome entered the area in, like 200 BC. And that's the kind of thing it is. And I don't discount the possibility that it's true. I just don't think that the evidence is there to support it as of yet. Although, the entire concept of them invalidating their claim to Israel, their claim to Israel is invalid anyway, because they chose Israel. They chose to fight Israel. They chose to try and get Palestine when there was free land in Argentina. They had a potential state in Kenya, in as well as Rhodesia, actually, as well as Bilojuban in Siberia. They could have had any of those, but they chose to basically terrorize the locals, wipe out the locals in Palestine, and then claim that they were the victims all along. That invalidates them, and the fact is that anyway, their claim on the basis of the Bible is basically fallacious, because the Bible is always conditional about it. You do not own the land, God does. If God says that you shall have it, you shall have it, but God hasn't said that yet. He hasn't that kind of thing. It's the logic behind the Zionist case doesn't hold up very well at all, which is why they spent so long, and Alan Dershowitz has been caught repeatedly trying to do it, trying to claim that there was no people in Palestine at the time, that it was abandoned land, so they couldn't possibly have killed 500,000 people just for not being Jewish and being where somewhere they wanted them to be. It's just a case of a difference of opinion, really, with Mars, I suppose. It's that I come from a different background, and, you know.
What I found interesting about these DNA studies, though, was actually that the Palestinians have more connection to ancient Israelite blood, and even a lot of them have the Kohanim chromosome, where that was the priestly class, which is what I found.
The Kohan modal haplotype, yeah. You're completely right.
So I found that completely interesting, that a lot of the Arabs have more Semitic blood than the...
Than the Ashkenazim.
Yes.
Bear in mind,
there are
three groups, yeah.
Go ahead, Carl.
Thanks for taking my call, and I'll listen to the rest of the program. I know there's other callers. Thanks.
All righty, thank you.
There's three groups. There's the Ashkenazim, there's the Sephardim, and there's the Mizrahim. Mizrahim are Middle Eastern Jews. Sephardim are from Spain, as in the Sephalad from Obadiah. And the Ashkenazim are the most recent of them all, coming basically being Germanic, Polish, Remote Russian, so forth. It's the Ashkenazim, the ones who are debated as to whether or not they came from the Khazaria. That doesn't affect the Sephardim or the Mizrahim. The Mizrahim and the Sephardim are actually very, very closely related to the Palestinians, whereas the Ashkenazim are where it is debated. And that's where, personally, I disagree with some people on the Khazaria thesis. But nevertheless, I agree that it's a possibility. It's just that we need more evidence if we're going to propose it.
Sure. Okay. So how have the Jews used the occult in order to facilitate Christian Zionism?
Well, because they need an enemy. Any good system, any good ideological system has a positive has its kind of hero. It has its hero function. It's like communism has portrayed the proletariat and Marx and so forth as being the heroes. Where it always had the enemy, it has the evil capitalist, the exploiter, and so forth. In much the same way, a Zionist Christian has exactly the same thing. They have the evil. They have the great positive Israel. Israel is there. Is what they worship. They worship this idea of that a Jewish Messiah is going to come and he's going to help them and he's going to create. The Jews are going to all convert to Christianity, and so forth. And then what will then happen is, and then you've got this kind of evil force, you know, the anti-Semites, the people who disagree with Israel, who more recently what they call the Islamo-fascists, and so forth, who are trying to fight against this inevitability, this idea that the world, there's this dark force. Because I mean, if you think about it, Christianity has two poles. You've got a dualism. You've got God and you've got the devil. You need to have the devil in order to have God for many Zionist Christians. And they see the devil as being very, very real because they're biblical literalists. They see that reality in the devil. And they have to assign him human minions. You know, this is why you often find them, they talk about the evil satanic bankers, the Illuminati, but they have to include real events. And one of the most important, of course, is World War II. So what you have to do, and because it created Israel, it's this great satanic conspiracy, which was destroyed by great American patriotism, and so forth. And then the Jews were allowed to settle in Israel, and this will now create the situation for the what they call the rapture, and so forth. This is kind of poles. You've got the good force, and you've got the bad force, and they've assigned the NSDAP and the Third Reich and fascism and so forth to be the bad area because that is how it's generally perceived, and also as a consequence of their own sort of almost Jewish worship. If you look at many Zionist Christians, you'll find Zionist Christian ideas, you often find that they derive from Jewish converts to Christianity, and there's many Jewish converts within Zionist Christianity, hence Jews for Jesus, who like to propound the idea that they actually know Christianity better than any Gentile Christian, because in their logic, Jesus was Jewish, therefore, as Jews, they know Christianity better. In much the same way, you get people like Brother Nathaniel, who will say, oh, I'm a Jew, therefore I know Jews better than any Gentile, therefore I'm the supreme authority upon the evil of the Jews, and so forth. That is the same logic, different scenario, if you like.
Right, okay. And of course, without Hitler, then we wouldn't have had Israel, and people have even written books saying that he was the creator, or one book that I'm thinking about, that he was the creator of Israel. And that is preposterous because, if you look at the transfer agreement and all the details involved in that, that stopped about 1937, 38, because they didn't want to do that to the Palestinians.
Yeah. More or less, yes.
Yes. Well, thank you so very much for being on the program today. It's been delightful as usual.
I'll be back, as they say.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Have a wonderful weekend.